The Approaching the Natural Podcast with Sid Garza Hillman. Sid is the author of Approaching the Natural, a health manifesto, a certified nutritionist, health coach, and programs director at the Stanford Inns Wellness Center on the Mendocino coast of California.
Hello, small steppers. Sid Garza Hillman here. Welcome to my show, my weekly podcast, where I discuss all things related to health and happiness and also my unique small steps approach to achieving ideally more of both of those, how to live better in this modern world that we're living in. It's got its challenges, and I'm hoping that my approach is a solution, or at least one solution, to living better for all of us. And if you are new to this podcast, which you might be, please go back and listen to other ones. Most of what this podcast is week to week is me just jabbering away, just yappity yappity yap. But in there, you'll get a really good sense of my approach and how I roll, and that's how you do it. But this week, I have an interview, so you also will learn if you're new here that I scatter interviews now and then, and my criteria is always just anybody who picks my interest, and there's no exception here. So quick couple things in case you don't know about me. I am a certified nutritionist. I'm a health coach. I run the Wellness Center at the Stanford Inn Eco Resort on the Mendocino coast of California. I work with people all over the country. And runner, you can just whatever, SidGarzaHillman.com. Okay, I'll leave some announcements at the end there. I will say that I started a running retreat today with Matt Frazier. Went on a nice run with a group, and super fun, great group of people, really fun. Came home, got in my pajamas, and podcasting in my pajamas. I just want you to know that. That's what's happening right now, and in case you're just joining me, nice having you here. Good luck. Okay. Should we get to this? I don't want to bore you with a bunch of crap, okay? I am doing a dial back day today. That's not crap. And all fruit day, second of all fruit in two weeks, and no problem. It's hot outside. I was actually digging it. Went to the market on the way home. Got some cantaloupes and just pears and nectar. Fruits aplenty. It's feeling. It's awesome. And so didn't really, not a lot of conflict there, okay? Got some really nice emails. I will be back next week because you know I will be. And I'll dive deeper into all that kind of stuff and what's going on and my usual thoughts and reminders about how to do this. Okay, you guys are awesome. I will jump in at the end of this interview with Garth Davis to discuss, you know, a few little announcements, and then we'll be on our way. Did I mention that the interview was with Garth Davis? Well, coincidentally, it is. So if you guys don't know who Garth Davis is, I had come across him because of his book, Proteinaholic, which is a heavy hitter, highly recommended. And I think the deal with me now is he gives me 99% of all of his sales, whether I recommend the book or not. So that's where I'm tied, just in the interest of transparency. No, there's no, I'm not, okay. I'm not tied to him at all. But I did know about the book, and it was a big fan. And then I was speaking in Marshall, Texas at the health, whatever they call it over there, and he was too. And so I met him there and basically just forced him. I'll be honest. I just forced him. I think I held somebody that he loves ransom. I don't remember how I did it, but I got him to be on the podcast. And then we met up again in New York, and I got him on a video of saying that he would be on it. And so that there is a verbal contract there. So there was really no way he could get out of it at this point. So I kept on him, and that's how he came to do this. And so it was very good. I think we had a really good conversation. I want you guys to check it out. Just a little bit about him. He's a medical director of the Davis Clinic in Houston, and he started on the TLC show Big Medicine. We didn't really even talk about that because we got deep on other cool stuff. He graduated from UT in Austin. It does say he was the student government president there, and I got to tell you, I was too of my elementary school. So for me, like, that's not that, like, I was totally a student government president. I'm just saying, I guess it's kind of cool, but he and I totally share that. So I feel like I'm kind of on the level with him. I don't want to go too much more. You can find out about him. His book is awesome. It's making waves. And he also, by the way, lives the example. He's in real good shape, very healthy. He's my age, so I appreciate that. And I don't know why, but just kind of like, you know, he's got kids, he's busy, and still living well. So we get into some cool stuff. I hope you dig it. Do one more quick thing is I just posted another video on my YouTube channel. So if you haven't subscribed, please get on there and subscribe. It's weekly, and I'm kind of thinking about upping it to 2 a week. So just putting it out there. Okay. So without much further yapping, see what I did there? Here's my interview with Garth Davis. Enjoy.
You did make a verbal contract with me in New York, so you kind of had no choice. did you ever watch that video?
No.
Which one? I'll have to send it to you. Well, it's on YouTube. I don't have to send it to you.
Oh, that's right. The video that we shot there. That's right.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, you're there. So sorry to hear about your bike accident. And just for listeners to know, Garth is joining me after a pretty bad spill on his bike that I can only say probably had to do with lack of protein. Am I right? Yes,
that's right. I was in a protein haze.
If you had eaten more protein. So people that eat protein a lot, they don't get in bike accidents. I think there's a study that shows that.
Yeah, that's the funny thing is, like, I saw a patient today who's hypothyroid, and her doctor told her it was because she's going vegan. Of course, she's been hypothyroid for years. The funny thing to me is, I was like, what does he tell all his meat eaters? Does he tell them that they're hypothyroid because what, the meat, or like, what's his? Why is the vegan? The reason she's hypothyroid is because of the vegan, and everybody else is hypothyroid for other reasons.
Probably he or she would probably say they're hypothyroid because they remind him of a vegan.
Maybe it, or they've been near a vegan.
I had a client once, similar thing, had cancer, colon and liver. And in surgery for the colon part of that, contracted a pretty bad bacterial infection in the hospital and was on heavy duty antibiotics, and the registered dietitian came in the room and asked him what he was eating, and he had just turned he had already been diagnosed with stage 4, but he had turned to plant-based and was actually feeling ironically pretty good. But he told her what the diet was, and she said, "Oh, you need to eat more protein." And he said, "Well, have you ever seen this kind of infection before?" And she said, "Yeah, lots of times." He goes, "Well, how many of those other patients were plant-based?" And she said, "None of them." And he goes, "Okay, well, so diet's sort of off the table then." When she said, you know, it's like just the rote response there.
It's the rote response.
Yeah. So part of what I wanted to talk to you about, and I know, you know, for my listeners, like, you had a pretty in-depth interview on Rich's podcast, which, you know, was really good. And I had already heard about you anyway. You know, I don't want to give too much credit to Rich because he has plenty where that came from. And but I did want to talk to you sort of the evolution of you as a doctor that's emerging in a field. This is what's a fast. I had Michelle McMack, and you know her, right?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, I had her on the podcast too, and we discussed this too. And I really want to discuss this with you and get your perspective on that. But for my listeners first, just briefly explain your background. I want to know why you embarked on the field that you've specialized in. You run your own clinic, unless it's just a coincidence that it's called the Davis Clinic. But you run your own clinic. Why that direction? What was your inspiration for that?
Okay. I mean, it's kind of a long story, if that's okay.
Yeah, totally.
So, you know, growing up, my father was a surgeon, and I always kind of, you know, go to, you know, some people, they go and play catch with their dad when they're younger. I used to go to surgery with my father. So I was somewhat groomed to be a surgeon from a young age, and I wanted to. It's not like he told me to be. It was an exciting job. My father seemed very professionally fulfilled, and I used to love watching him go and see patients and do surgery. And this idea that I could go in and fix someone was something that I was really into. In fact, in high school, I played football, though I kind of rode the bench. And I got in one play, and I got knocked out during that play. And when I woke up, I kept repeating, "Can I still be a doctor? Can I still be a doctor?" And my friends still make fun of me over that. So I obviously want to be a doctor from a young age. I went to medical school. You know, medical school is interesting. It's such a study on pathophysiology. And while there is a study on physiology, what I mean to say is that there's such a study on disease, but not really a study on wellness. In other words, it's weird kind of when you look at the way we learn medicine in Western medicine, we almost get sold this idea that the body is born broken.
Right.
And,
right.
And our job is to fix it. And there's such super specialization now that no doctor is really treating the whole body. I mean, yeah, family practice doctors treat the whole person, but it's still, they do it by a disease process kind of review. No one's really looking at the whole patient's health. And so, in other words, you have a heart problem, the heart doctor takes care of it. You got
that's
a lung problem.
At that point. Yeah.
And so in the end, we get such a compartmentalized view. I always remember this time that it kind of dawned on me. We started referring to patients when we were doing rounds by their disease process rather than who they were. It wasn't like Mrs. Smith in room 101. It was, the colon cancer in room 101 and the breast cancer. And that's kind of what it was. It was all about disease. It wasn't about preventing disease. In fact, when we talked about preventative health, we really didn't talk about health. We talked about mammograms, which aren't disease prevention. They're early diagnosis. And so I kind of came out of medicine just thinking everybody's body was broken. It was my job to fix it. But then, a few things started happening over time. So I got out of got out into the field of surgery. And then the department chair said to me, there's this big movement in weight loss surgery and we need someone to kind of look into it. The surgery is complex and it was done laparoscopically. And that's what I was kind of trained to do, is do these surgeries through small incisions. So I thought I'd look into it. And the results were pretty surprising. I mean, the surgery really did a good job for people. And it was kind of an exciting surgery to do because, usually a surgeon does an appendix, dig it out. You never see the surgeon again. There's no real connection with the person. And I kind of really liked the connection with people. And I didn't feel like I was getting that much with surgery in general. But as I got into this weight loss surgery field, there was a deep connection with the patients. And I got to follow them through this amazing kind of transformation that they went through from someone who's been overweight all their life to someone who's thin. Now, still, I wasn't really concentrating on diet. To me, they were overweight because, they were surgically deplete of a weight loss surgery and they needed surgery in order to fix it. And I did that and made it better. But over time, over following people, one of the worst things you could see is you get all excited that someone loses weight from weight loss surgery, then to see them start gaining weight again.
Right.
That's a very, very discouraging, very obviously for the patient and for me as the surgeon who had been busy patting himself on the back that he got this person to lose all their weight. And so I started kind of taking a more keen interest in why were they overweight to begin with and why are they failing now? I mean, they've got this weight loss surgery. Why is it failing? And I would go to these weight loss surgery. I mean, Sid, you would die. go to these week-long weight loss surgery conferences and we'd be talking about people failing weight loss surgery, but we never talked about diet. I mean, all day long, the discussion would be like, they failed this weight loss surgery. What other surgery can I do to make the surgery work? Maybe it's something that they're eating. And we had this very same kind of comment, just eat more protein. That was always just tell them to eat protein. They need to eat more protein. They're not eating enough protein. But then I'd look at my patients' diet logs and they were like, I'm doing everything. I'm eating eggs and bacon for breakfast. I'm eating, hamburger for lunch. Sometimes I leave out the bun, because it's the bun's problem. And I'd look at their diet and I'd be like, it's kind of like what I'm eating too. And then an interesting thing happened is that I wasn't feeling good. I was feeling really crappy. I had really bad, irritable bowel syndrome. I started gaining weight. But, of course, I blame this all on just being a busy surgeon.
Sure.
I was having my first child. And so I was about 35 years old and I had to get an insurance policy. So they took my labs. And my cholesterol level came back sky high.
Like 300s?
It was, I think it was 250 something. My LDL was 195. And my triglycerides were high and my liver function tests were elevated because I had fatty liver and I was hypertensive.
Yikes.
And so this was a big shock to me because I was and the other thing that happened around that same time is I went to get my eyes examined and the optometrist was like, you've got cholesterol deposits in your eyes.
Oh, you're joking.
No, yeah, I had what's called arcosinellus. And so I was like, this is crazy because I had thought of myself as a healthy person. I just didn't expect I went to see, my friend, internal medicine doctor, no problem. We could start you on Lipitor and we could start you on a blood. But I know how that is. I know that one medication leads to two, to three, to four, and this is an ongoing problem. And it really took, I was like, how could I be telling people to be healthy, be in a field where I'm trying to help people lose weight, and yet I'm gaining weight, and I have all these same disease processes my patients have? And I really started looking at, well, if I basically started looking at the diet of America, because I said, well, obviously, we're all eating the same, very similar diet. And you would think of – I thought of as America as having the best weight, you know, the best nutrition and best health in the world. I was kind of naive in that way. I thought, well, America, we got everything, right? We got the best healthcare system. And then I found out that we live the shortest of, you know, we rank like 57th in life expectancy and number one in obesity and number one in diabetes. And this really took me as a surprise of why are we so overweight? Why are we so sick? And not only why are we so sick, but what are the people that are healthy doing? And as I started studying that, it was kind of a big awakening that lifestyle is such a huge part of the diseases that we have, and that the surgery works, but the surgery needs to be a tool to help someone change their lifestyle. And if I'm not changing people's lifestyles, I'm not fixing them.
Right.
And that's kind of converted me into this kind of almost lifestyle medicine / surgeon.
So a couple things came up for me. So you said, you know, how can I be this level of health if I'm helping people to become healthy? But then you sort of corrected yourself to say helping people lose weight. I'm interested in the mindset of you at that time. Did you think of health? Because what I was hearing from you is you kind of didn't even really think about health in that way. You go to these conferences, there's no discussion of diet or anything like that. Did you view your job as making people healthy, or were you narrowed in your view of, it's not even on the radar, I'm helping people to lose weight. That's what I do.
A little bit of both. I mean, weight was definitely the focus, right? And now weight is not my focus so much, but weight was my sole focus. We did, you know, there's some interesting results with weight loss surgery and diabetes. And so, you know, we did treat diabetes pretty well with the surgery. And so I would think of myself as treating a disease, but I didn't really, I mean, the term health for a Western doctor is just, health is almost like, I don't know, absence of disease.
I was just going to say disease-free. And what's interesting to me, and I really want you to talk about this a little bit. So Western medicine is special. I mean, it is specialized, as you said. And when you have a general practitioner and then something gets a little bit more into a defined, you know, problem, they, you know, he or she will typically refer you to somebody who is specialized. Is that not necessary given the complexity of the body? I mean, it seems like specializations are a necessity. I think what you're talking about or getting to is, and what I'm definitely getting to is, what is the mindset even behind whether you're specialized or not? What is your goal? And is that what's fed to you in the training of becoming a doctor? It seems like that's not the backdrop, whether you're specialized or not. The backdrop isn't, okay, yes, you need to be specialized because, you know, the heart is such a complex organ, and so you've got to learn everything about it. You don't have time to learn anything about the pancreas while you're learning about the heart, et cetera, et cetera. But there's still that backdrop of like, okay, we're trying to fix a broken body. Where does that come from?
Yeah, I mean, correct. We do need specialists. There's no question. And I'm not knocking Western medicine. There's going to be a role for Western medicine. There will always be a role for Western medicine. But what we don't have is a specialist that's preventing someone from getting sick in the first place. Like even a general practitioner, while they're taking care of the whole person, so they're not specialized in any one thing, you would think that their specialty would be trying to keep people healthy. But they have about 15 minutes with a patient, and it's pretty hard for them to take the time or to even know how to keep someone from getting cancer or to keep someone from getting heart disease. And in fact, a lot of Western medicine doctors, because we're not taught it, just it's hard. Well, look, we're painting in big, broad brush strokes here, but it's hard for me to tell. Some doctors avoid lifestyle because they don't have time to talk about it, because they were never taught about it, or because they don't believe it really makes a difference. Like I gave a talk to a bunch of endocrinologists about how diet can have a huge effect on diabetes, and how switching to a plant-based model is excellent for diabetes. And, you know, obviously I always carry with me a lot of scientific studies and go over the science, and the endocrinologists were fairly convinced, but they were kind of like, yeah, I mean, okay, this makes a point, but no one's going to change their diet anyway, so I'm just going to give them medicine. I mean, this is all nice theoretically, but you really can't change anybody's diet. Like there's almost this paternalistic view in medicine that people won't change or can't change. And so we need to treat their disease with medicines, give them a pill, call me in the morning type.
Well, I have a couple of my closest friends in Los Angeles are both pediatricians, and we've talked about that kind of thing, which is they'll recommend sometimes dietary change. They'll actually do that. And they said a lot of times the patient, or at least because they're pediatricians, the parents of the patient will be like, well, we're not changing our diet. So give me another option.
Well, it's completely 100% true. So this is not all on the doctor.
Right. And I don't want to paint it on the doctor at all. My question only is it almost like a chick, which came first, chicken or the egg? Is it the job of, I just don't know if it's the job of the doctor. I don't know if it's in the doctor's job description to be consulted on something like preventative health when their job is to treat what they're trained to treat via surgery and drug therapy and like this. I think, would you agree that you're an anomaly? I mean, I know there's more doctors obviously emerging every day that bring in a dietary aspect to their training, but I think, you know, industry-wide, you're fairly an anomaly, except to say, I would say you're just better informed, but my pediatrician tells me when I go to the doctor with my children, which is rare, you should feed them cow's milk. They're not even reading the studies on nutrition. You are. I wrestle with this a lot because I almost feel like maybe it's not in your job description, not you, but like their job description. Like, don't weigh in on it because that's not what I go to you for.
Yeah, I mean, so first of all, people definitely go to a doctor for a treatment plan. And they want the pill, which is why we have such, you know, excess antibiotic usage. Just because people come, they've got a virus, they want an antibiotic. The doctor's like, okay, fine, here's an antibiotic.
Right.
And now we've got this. And so there's just that kind of feeling. I'm going to a doctor, I don't want to be taught, you know, I'm not going to change my lifestyle, so give me the medicines to treat the problems that my lifestyle is causing. I mean, that's definitely something that's out there. Now, yeah, I agree with you. Doctors are not currently trained enough to make these recommendations on how to change lifestyle. So it kind of isn't their job anymore. But I do think that this rests in the realm of medicine. I think wellness needs to be a part of medical training in the future. And I think that we need to start in medical school, starting to train people how to prevent their patients from getting sick in the first place. And there needs to be some people that practice quote unquote lifestyle medicine. There's this new movement towards functional/lifestyle medicine. It's filled with both good and bad stuff in it. And it hasn't been well defined just yet. What is lifestyle medicine? What is the diet we're supposed to be telling people? What are the other, you know, supplements and things that go along with that? But I do think eventually this is going to need to be a part of medicine, because the other thing is you got to understand that the payers want this. So you look at something like Kaiser Permanente. You know, Kaiser and a lot of these HMO type setups and with accountable care organizations, you're going to see a lot of this. The model is switching. The model used to be you made money off of disease, but the future model is going to be you made money off of people being healthy. And under such a model, you're going to want treatment to be prevention. And so I think in the future, the doctors of the future are going to be much more versed in how to keep people from being sick in the first place.
Well, and I think there's actually other systems. I think England being one of them, where clinics are awarded, you know, for weight loss of their patients, for decreased cholesterol of their patients, for things like that. There are it's incentivized in that fashion.
Sure. And anytime you get into a capitated care model, so for instance, like in Kaiser, you know, they have a covered life. That covered life pays a certain amount of money, whatever it is, to be in the system. Obviously, if that person doesn't utilize the system, Kaiser makes money. If the person starts getting surgeries and medications and all this stuff, Kaiser loses money. So there's a huge interest in Kaiser and keeping people healthy. And so that's the kind of model you want, is this interest in keeping people healthy to begin with.
Now, are you in just out of curiosity, are you involved, like industry, I guess it would be the American Medical Association would be the governing body of, here's what's taught in medical. Here's my worry. My worry is that floodgates open, doctors now advise on nutrition. Okay, so let's say that's our premise. But I guess like in anything else they advise on, there's going to be good doctors and not so good doctors. At what point does it become part of the training of in medical schools, or is it going to be, well, I've got to find the medical school that trains in that, but most don't. If you have, I mean, I know that the level that you've studied this had all happened post your medical school, post your residency, post your internship. This all happened while you were already a practicing doctor. This didn't, you didn't come out of medical school versed in nutrition. Yeah. How do I trust as a patient going to another doctor that advises on nutrition, having done none of the research that you're doing, and where are they going to get the information that they, where is the doctor, the pediatrician that tells me to feed my children cow's milk? Because trust me, I don't ask. I go, okay, yeah, great, great. And I walk out the door. Where does that person get that information? Where is it coming from?
Dogma.
You, I mean, just like cultural dogma, or are there, I will tell you, no, I have a
medical dogma. So for instance, in the, my field in weight loss surgery, the dogma is high protein. Now, I looked back at the research to try to find where this even started, and I couldn't find it.
That's what I want to know.
And so there isn't any research. It's just this kind of belief that – I should take it back. There's about two or three papers, but they're really bad. And so there's just really little science to support it. But again, weight loss surgeons really aren't thinking much about diet. They're thinking about the surgery and how to do the surgery properly. And our journals are filled with little minutia about how to make the surgery more effective, but they're just not concentrating on the diet. So they just take the dogma because that's easy.
But where did you, like before you knew, when you mentioned, you know, the high protein thing, do you remember a point in time where you were either told that or heard it?
Yes.
Well, when was that?
That was when I, so when I first started doing weight loss surgery, I would go to other weight loss surgeons that were already practicing this and follow them through the day and see what they were teaching patients. And then I started going to our national society's meetings. And at our national society meeting, this is, you know, high protein diet, eat your protein first. And this was all part of my first book I ever wrote. It was called The Expert's Guide to Weight Loss Surgery. And in it, it says, eat your protein first. 30% of your calories need to come from protein, which is extremely high.
Right.
And that was all. And that funny, that book is like filled with science, except that part was pure dogma. I didn't present any science with that. I presented just this is the way it is.
Totally fascinating. And by protein, I'm sure you weren't talking about kale.
I was not. I didn't know kale had protein.
Yeah, and that's the you know, that's part of the fear that I mean, this happened this morning when I was teaching a class, and it's like, well, my doctor told me, I'm pre-diabetic. I needed to be on a high protein diet. And I was like, well, interestingly, I'm going to be talking to Dr. Garth Davis today. Cause it's, you know, it's like, it just sort of like comes out. I have a brochure that I show when I do talks, it was when we were in the OBGYN's office, my wife was pregnant with our twins, and it's a nutrition during pregnancy brochure, and it's the copyright on the back says National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
Of course, yeah.
Now that's blatant, but did you ever come across something like that that was just like, oh yeah, here's our USDA nutritional guide that we were handed somewhere?
Oh, it's everywhere.
But I mean, did you see that when you were in school or anything?
Look, you know, a lot of times it's more subtle. Like for instance, the in bariatrics, there's a big push towards protein, and there are a whole bunch of companies selling protein products.
Right.
And so they come to you saying, "Oh, this protein product is so great for weight loss," and da-da-da-da-da. And so, you know, you think, "Oh, look, this protein product is good for weight loss because I got this article from this protein company who's going to provide protein and even give me money to use the protein powder a percentage of the protein that we sell." The industry influence is all over the place.
Gotcha. And do these people walk into your office? Because that would be hilarious.
Oh, of course.
And you go, well, actually, you just walked into the wrong office.
Oh, yeah. Nowadays, most people know with me not to do it. We do have to use, you know, with weight loss surgery patients and right before surgery and after surgery, we do have to use some protein supplements. But, you know, they know with me not to push it beyond.
Yeah. I mean, and that's an acute situation, right? I mean, it's not like you're not advising that on lifestyle.
I absolutely hate it when people are doing them long term.
Right.
And so it's only a short period and my patients are well informed.
Right.
It's not supposed to be long term.
Right. So the next thing I wanted to talk to you about is the concept of research. Obviously, you know, your book, Proteinaholic, is chock full. And you know, of course, you've been, you know, the I just was shocked at, I think you and I talked about it in Texas when we met, but the, or New York maybe, but the woman who supposedly debunked you, you know, and she's mentioned in your book, so I'm sure that there's like a personal vendetta against you, but the woman who debunked you based on 92 pages or whatever the heck her writing was, and you've been responding, which is blows my mind. I don't know, how many hours did that take you to respond point by point?
I've just done one part, and I've got multiple other parts, but I just don't have the time to.
Yeah, I mean, it's massive.
But I mean, it's, if you just read the first part of my response, I mean, it's just, you know, what she calls debunking. Like, I mean, like her first and biggest complaint was she said that Lester Morrison's study showed that someone ate 120 grams of protein. Well, when I first read that, I was like, who's Lester Morrison? Because I didn't remember even mentioning him in the book. And he is literally one line, and I don't even quote his paper because I didn't even look up his paper because it had nothing to do with the book. And that's her big complaint. And so, and then I, of course, I looked it up, and Lester Morrison did not say 120 grams of protein. And so, you know, but this is typical, right? I mean, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. There's some people that fight so hard. Now, her in particular, I actually respect her more than the usual person. She actually does read a lot of science, and while she's not an expert in science in any way, shape, or form, she's very well informed, and she does make some good arguments, and I go into that stuff in my response to her. But there's so many other, like today on Testosterone Nation, of course, anybody who reads a website called Testosterone Nation and believes anything, and then they put in there vegan, I can't remember, something like vegans don't know how to read science. Of course, written by a person who's not a scientist at all.
Right.
It is just the most hilarious thing to me that someone who's not a scientist, that has no backing in the field of science, can say a comment like that. Is just absolutely ridiculous. And so he starts discussing, I could read through it, just immediately realize this person has no idea what they're talking about, but they have a huge influence on the public. And it's kind of sad, but it's the situation we're in this multimedia, international, global internet culture we live in.
Yeah, and you have to sort of choose your, you know, as I call them in my podcast, which nutty nut to, you know, to actually engage with, you know, or hopefully they're not that way, and you engage with them on a respectful, information based level. Yeah. With that said, do you feel like when you were writing your book, did you feel the inclination like I really got to go overboard here? It's like, to me, it seems a little bit crazy, and I don't really even on my podcast discuss vegan or not. I'm all about the bigger picture than even just food, but clearly moving people to more ideally nutrient dense food, you know, over time, et cetera, via small steps, blah, blah, blah. But do you feel like it's unnecessarily the burden of proof is on you? At what point do we go, the science is there. We can get mired in the research discussion, and then you're going to find 10 studies that show that milk is good for you, and I'm going to show 10 studies that milk is, or you're going to find that 10 that are bad for you, let's say. I'm going to find 10 that are good for me, and then we're going to go head to head in social media on this thing. And then we got to talk about, no, your study's biased. Well, no, your study's biased. And it's like this rabbit hole that I feel like we never get out of to the point where we can start living our lives because we know enough already. What are your thoughts on that?
No, I mean, that's, you know, I'm at that point now. I'm tired of arguing about it. Like, I could go on and start arguing with this guy from Testosterone Nation, but why am I arguing with a guy from Testosterone Nation?
Right.
You know, I mean, if you're getting your health advice from Testosterone Nation, then that's a problem. It turns out that a lot of these debates are being held by such pseudo experts that really can't fathom or understand the true science. And they believe that one article is equal to another article, which is absolutely not true. There's scientific method. There's all kinds of – in order – you know, as a scientist, we have a hypothesis. We actually are supposed to prove the null hypothesis. In other words, anytime that I do a study, my goal should be to prove myself wrong. Right, and a good study is organized like that. A good study does not have any industry bias to it. And it's not one study. Like, I make this point in the book a lot. For instance, I have each chapter organized, you know, when I get into the disease parts, like a chapter on diabetes and a chapter on heart disease, et cetera. I can't say that there is one study that proves that meat causes diabetes. That would be crazy. Because even if I had one study, the whole point in scientific method is to take that study and see if you could reproduce it. Like kind of like Koch's postulate, where you got to be able to reproduce it. So can I reproduce it? Is it reproducible? Are there multiple studies that show this? Is there epidemiologic data? Is there randomized controlled data? Is there mechanism of action? So, for instance, in the diabetes chapter, what I wanted to do is show, number one, that when you look at population data and from all over the world in multiple different studies where they did all kinds of controls and it was prospective, really well done studies, meat correlates with diabetes. Now, correlation does not mean causation, right, but when you've got correlation in multiple different studies where they've done multivariate analysis and they've controlled for confounding factors and you see it in multi different studies, you got to believe where there's smoke, there's fire. So then I go and look at the smoke and look for the fire, and I try to show that there's an absolute mechanism of action that we can show you that has been studied over and over in labs that shows how meat can cause diabetes. Then I show randomized controlled trials where we test this hypothesis and show that if we stop someone who has diabetes from eating meat, that we can control their diabetes. And so it's this kind of conglomeration. You need, in order to be able to argue about the science of nutrition, you need to know the full breadth of that science, and that's extremely important. And so a lot of times, you know, I just recently went to a conference, and now we're having debates about nutrition, but on a much broader, wider scientific scale with scientists. And the Duke people have been very big on the high protein, high fat diets. And, you know, they get up there and they present their data, but the guy was very clear. This never happens in the internet, right? He goes, I could present you a lot of data that shows that my high protein, high fat diet will help people lose weight and that it will help with control of cholesterol in this certain model, and it will help with diabetes in a certain model. But, and he admitted this, I cannot show any end organ benefit long term because don't have long term studies and because the people don't stick with the diet long term. And so I can't make a statement that it cures diabetes or that it cures heart disease.
Now, and cholesterol and weight loss are only two markers, and neither are about health in general.
Right, exactly. So he admits that. He says, I can't make a statement on health in general. I can only make it on these markers. Meanwhile, I can make a statement on health in general because I've got long-term data on end organ disease processes as it's affected by a vegan diet. And so that's a really big difference. And the subtlety of that is missed. And, you know, I can't discuss that with someone from Testosterone Nation.
Right.
You know, they simply don't understand that. And so discussing it with them is ridiculous. Their understanding of nutrition is totally mixed with what they see in a bodybuilder who to them, you know, the bodybuilder exemplifies what's perfection, which is absolutely ridiculous because bodybuilders, there was a recent study, have extremely short life expectancies, die at a very early age, and are all on steroids. And so these bodies are actually fake. They're not an example of health. They're actually an example of disease.
Well, and that goes for even, you know, being skinny doesn't necessarily mean health either. And I think we use the aesthetic, you know, to say, well, he's a big weightlifter and he drinks whey protein powder. Therefore, it's whey protein powder is necessary for weight training. And it, you know, and again, the health is not part of that conversation.
Yeah. It just simply isn't.
It's not, right. So, but do you feel like I mean, you were talking about industry. I mean, let's face it. You're talking about industry. You're talking about, you know, even in your case, you know, protein powder companies coming into your door. I think that the sort of, you know, the cultural, like you said, just this idea of high protein, it sort of exists. It's now almost like the idea exists independent of people now, you know, and it's just kind of, if you ask somebody, well, where did you hear that? Sometimes they can't answer, you know, I don't, it just is, you know, and that kind of thing. So is the burden of proof on you to not only do the research, but just to justify the research? And at what point are you feeling, or do you feel like you're just not convincing people? Or do you feel like, are you getting through to people who are at first naysayers, but go, yeah, all right?
No, I do think we're getting through to people. I think there's a definite tangible change. I mean, it's changed just in the 10 years that I've been investigating nutrition. I've seen very big changes, a much higher acceptance. I think the fact that Testosterone Nation is even running an article about vegan diet and the science behind it and citing the science is an example. It's thou doth protest too much. They're feeling the heat.
Yeah, yeah, got it.
And so there definitely is a movement. There's a huge movement towards plant based diet in athletics. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can see the number one male and female tennis players right now are plant based.
Are they really?
There's a bunch of MMA fighters that are plant based. There's football players, and so there's a big movement in athletics. There's a big movement in pop culture, so you're seeing a lot of singers and actors and actresses that are following this. And there's a big movement in science. I mean, the science behind plant-based diet is coming every day. There's another article about it. And so I think it's being discussed. I mean, 10 years ago, I don't think people even knew what a vegan was.
Right.
But now it's almost becoming, a common part of a discussion. And when I go to a national meeting for the American Society of Metabolic and Bariatric Physicians, or now it's called the Obesity Medical Association. And when I first started going to them, there wasn't – vegetarian diet and vegan diet wasn't discussed. Now when I go there, there's always a talk about vegan diet. There's always a talk about high-protein diet, and they're always kind of compared and contrasted. And so it's become part of the lexicon in discussion, and so that's a huge move. And so I don't think it could be denied. It's just very hard. The science is so strong for a plant-based diet that there's no way it could be hidden for much longer.
And do you have to get into the discussion about, because to me, vegan diet is almost, it doesn't even work, because vegan is a I don't eat this and this and this, but it can, what you do eat can be a whole bunch of stuff. And as you know, it can be super unhealthy stuff too. So when there's a discussion about vegan diet, I always get I knew somebody who was vegan and they didn't have any energy. It's like, yeah, because they were drinking freaking Coke and eating potato chips all day, who knows? But the point is how much of that do you get into in terms of educating your colleagues to say, okay, well, let's not talk vegan. Let's talk about nutrient density.
Don't actually use the term vegan almost ever. I've been using it more lately because vegan is an ethic, right?
Right.
I mean,
right.
It's not really
– It's not a diet.
No. The diet I when I use the term, I say plant-based.
And do you say whole plant-based, or you just – whole food, it's inferred. Plant-based. Yeah, whole food plant, right.
Most of us are starting to use that kind of lexicon, whole food plant-based diet.
And when you say that in the field, do doctors – do they go, well, what's that? Or do they go, yeah, I've heard of that?
They kind of get it.
Yeah.
They get vegetarian and whole food plant-based. They don't, of course, what they get with vegetarians often, so that means you eat chicken,
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I get it. But whole food plant-based diet, when I counsel my patients, I don't tell them to go vegan. I tell them I want a whole food plant-based diet, so that if they eat meat here and there, I don't go crazy. If they eat a little fish, I can't argue with, because actually fish has come off. We could go off on fish.
Yeah.
Fish has come off. So a little bit of fish is actually probably good for you, provided it's reliably sourced. So, with my patients, I really try to drill in plant-based. In other words, when you end the day and you look back, most of what you ate should have come from the plant kingdom.
Caloric. Yeah.
I am starting to talk more about vegan, and I guess it's because I'm a little tired with the even trying to argue with people. Look, the science to me is so strong. It's almost like trying to argue against someone that smoking is bad for you. I mean, it took thousands and thousands of scientific articles and never a randomized controlled trial. Like, they were all correlation studies to show that smoking was bad for us. Thousands before we listened. And so it's probably going to take thousands in this regard too. And that'll take a chip. But I'm getting kind of tired of arguing about it, because it just doesn't even seem – I'm a very open-minded guy, and I will listen to the other side. In fact, it was being open-minded that got me to be plant-based in the beginning, because I wasn't plant-based.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I wasn't either.
But it's just getting kind of old. I mean, these arguments are getting old, and this correlation, not causation, and this, that, and the other are really starting to be, frankly, stupid. But I think there is something to this idea of veganism, of there being an ethic to the way we eat, because the other thing we don't talk about is the absolute destroyal of our environment. And, one thing that got me to use the term vegan more lately has been the USDA, because the USDA got an experts panel. And they were arguing for, less meat in the diet, but part of their argument for less meat in the diet was its effect on the environment. And I thought it was interesting that a governmental group of scientists was actually drawing attention towards the effect, and they actually made a statement that we ought to think about the way we eat and its effect on the environment. And of course we should, because the way we eat and the way we raise our food is the most, it has the largest effect on the environment. And so that ought to be part of what we think. And so I've started to appeal a little bit more to that regard, because people seem to listen to that even more than they do their health.
Even patients?
No, this is more my kind of public
persona. I was going to say, yeah, because in the patient realm, it's like you got to keep it to the...
Yeah, I don't have time to talk about that with patients. So,
yeah, I know. But even so, you know, like I've said, nutritionally speaking, like you just said, you can eat a little bit of, you know, it's the proportion of calories of whole plants to non-whole plant calories. And that's going to sort of determine your level of health overall, at least in, as it relates to food. And so I find that really interesting. And are your, do you, see, I meet plenty of so-called vegans who, even though they're vegan, they still are hung up about the protein thing. So it's not like it's non-vegans who are worried about protein. It's vegans and vegan and non-vegans alike. Do you find the same thing?
Absolutely.
I mean, it blows my mind. At these veg fests and stuff, it's still like a lot of the products sold at the booths, you know, are high, are pro, they can be protein powders, protein bars, protein this, protein that. Right. It's an uphill climb to say, okay, the human – so this is when I want to get into a little bit of science, because I've talked about on the podcast a little bit, but I try not to do too much on food. But I want to – if you wouldn't mind briefly talking about the recycling of protein process in the body. This is so fascinates me, and how that relates to how much dietary protein we need to actually consume on a day-to-day basis without having to get into – people want to go, well, how much protein should I eat then? It's like, oh my gosh, there's no way you can answer that question, but I think there's generalities.
I mean, there's definitely generalities. We are constantly recycling protein. We're constantly recycling all of ourselves. And so we don't have stores per se of amino acids like we do for carbohydrates. We've got glycogen stores, but we don't have that for protein. But we are constantly recycling. So there's this kind of labile amino acid availability in the blood at any given time. We do need protein, and in fact, protein is extremely important, and it's so important that it's in just about everything we eat. And so the question is, are we getting adequate protein on a plant diet? Well, here's the thing. They did, you know, the RDA, in order to come up with how much protein we ate, did a lot of research, and it's been going on for years and years and years. And the World Health Organization has done similar research, and what they look at is nitrogen utilization. And they could tell by measuring the stool and the urine and the amount of protein eaten, they could estimate, you know, the protein balance and whether or not people are protein deficient. And what they found is that people don't need that much protein. In fact, probably in the 30s to 40s. Now, they wanted to grams a day. Now, they wanted to make certain that no one was left out. In other words, if you're looking at a normal curve and the average person needs 35 grams of protein, they want to make sure that there's no way that they're wrong about that. So they did what's called standard deviation. They went up two standard deviations, meaning that 98, if whatever number that they give, that will be enough protein for 98%+ of the population. And that number in men is 56 grams, and in women it's 46 grams. And obviously that's the average person. If you're an athlete, that may change a bit. Different things are going to change different things, right? That being said, I was really impressed when I was looking at the, you know, some of the, and I go into this a bit in the how much protein do we need chapter of my book, that even like, for instance, bodybuilders, you would think, okay, well, bodybuilders need more protein because they're building more muscle. But I was surprised that, yeah, they probably need more than the 56, but the studies don't show that they need what we're typically told, which like bodybuilders are told to eat 2.5 grams per pound, which is, you know, an insane amount of protein. But it doesn't seem like they actually need that much, and that in fact 1.1 might be enough. And what I really wanted to draw attention on the book is because the one thing we've always thought is you can't get too much protein. I wanted to show in the book that actually you probably could get too much protein.
Well, and if you're talking about the, you know, tell my listeners real quick about, you know, the nitrogen load, and I mean that's the defining factor of an amino acid is what is the nitrogen, presence of nitrogen, what that effect is on the body. I mean, you can't, according to Joel Fuhrman, Americans are eating 2 to 5 times too much protein. What is the effect of that on the body?
Well, I mean, there's so many effects. So first of all, it depends what kind of amino acid you're eating. So some amino acids have a sulfur component to it. And that sulfur is acidic when it's absorbed in the body, and so you create an acidosis-type response. Of course, it turns out that animal protein has a lot more sulfur amino acids than plant protein, which is why we see an acidosis response. And when you get an acidosis response, your body has to neutralize that, and it does that by leaching calcium from muscles. And so one part of the book I try to show is that it's possible that eating all this protein is actually harming our muscles rather than helping the muscle.
And bones, too.
What's that?
And it leaches calcium from the bones as well.
It does. Funny enough, it hasn't. We're not positive about that as much as we used to be. We used to think it did more from the bones. It may actually be more from the muscle than the bones. But it's true to say that people that, you know, that we think dairy is good for the bones, but there have been studies showing that higher dairy intake has been associated with worse bones.
Right.
But there's many other things. So amino acids could create acidosis, but they also stimulate the body to secrete something called IGF-1.
Right.
Now, IGF-1 has been very tied to cancer. Certain amino acids actually stimulate fat intake into muscle cells, and fat intake into muscle cells
for the diabetes
creates diabetes, intramyocytic right. cycles, insulin resistance. And the other thing is, you got to understand, you're never eating that amino acid by itself. You're eating that amino acid as part of a whole food that has with it saturated fat. And that meat, that muscle that you're eating also has in it endotoxins, byproducts of bacteria, because meat usually has a lot of bacteria in it. You might kill off the bacteria when you cook it, but you're getting the endotoxins, which create inflammation. And so meat is definitely inflammatory. Meat also has arachidonic acid in it, which creates inflammation. A lot of meat has heme iron, which is in very high phosphorus levels, which we have found creates disease. And then meat also, when you cook it, creates a compound called the heating process with the amino acid causes heterocyclic amines. And those are cancer causing. I mean, I could go on and on and on with all the different things that happen. AGEs and N-nitroso compounds and thermoresistant viruses. There are so many different components of meat that have a very deleterious effect on our body.
Right. And do you think that the evolution of the species, our species, this is where don't get me started on paleo because it's so ridiculous even anthropologically, but where by most accounts, it was a very little amount of our overall caloric intake. Obviously, before industry, we didn't have refined plants. So when we ate plants, they were by default whole plants. And so overall, the bulk of our calories came from whole plants, no oil, no white flour, no white sugar kind of stuff. And then a little bit of animal protein or animal food. I find it interesting that like beef, I think on average is around 28% protein and sort of in the urban vernacular, we'll call it protein, but it's actually more fat anyway. Yeah. And why is that just never discussed?
Yeah, I always think it's funny, like, you know, I feel sorry for the poor waiters that have to deal with me, but, you know, they always come up to you and I say, I'll take a salad. And they're like, would you like a protein with that
That's
salad?
That's right, right.
And that drives me crazy. So I'm always like, and my wife's like, please calm down. And I'm like, well, what do you mean by protein? Like, well, would you like some steak with it or some chicken? I'm like, well, technically there's more calories from fat than there is from protein. So why don't you ask me if I want some fat with it? And then, you know.
Right.
Poor 16-year-old guy is like, leave me alone.
Yeah. But at the same time, it is just – and I don't know if – that's probably industry-driven too.
Oh, that's a huge industry. Look, the one thing's for sure. The industry has caught on to this protein craze. And they know that if it says protein, we want to buy it. And so the big success for the meat industry was this kind of reductionist nutrition – where we stopped talking about meat being bad for you. We started talking about fat because then they could say, well, they've got lean meat, it's low fat. And then they could bring up that meat is high in protein. So they could say, well, it's high in protein, so it's good for you.
Right. And just somehow became the word protein. It has become, I mean, I just was teaching this morning. It's like I show them the .gov plate that has vegetables, grains, fruit, and protein, and I always say, you know, I've just taught them this whole thing about nutrition. And I say, okay, look at this plate. What doesn't belong and why? And they get hung up on it because they still see protein as a food. And I go, that's not food. That's in food, you know. Yes. And vegetables are food, fruits food, grains food, proteins not food. It's in food, and it's actually in vegetables, fruit, and grains. And so, but I wanted to just ask you to clarify real quick, because you know spinach is about 40% protein, and so technically, if you just ate spinach all day, you would get more protein if you ate the same amount of calories as you would get from beef if you ate the same amount of calories of beef per day. Why isn't the load on the body as damaging via spinach as it is in beef? If you could just explain that real quick.
Okay, first of all, we can't eat that much spinach.
But if just hypothetically.
But hypothetically. Yeah, I mean, well, I mean, there's quite a few things. So we can't eat that much spinach. Number two, a lot of the amino acids, again, they're not as acidic as the meat protein amino acid makeup. And so you're not getting really high sulfuric type acids. You're not getting things like methionine, which stimulate cancer cells. You're not stimulating IGF-1 because it turns out that it's very certain amino acids that stimulate IGF-1. Same with the intake of fat into the muscle cell. It's more alanine and leucine. You're not getting as much leucine in plant-based proteins. Leucine has been tied to activating mTOR, which is an aging sequence. And so it turns out that the amino acid spectrum of the spinach is better than the amino acid spectrum of the meat. But on top of that, you're also not getting the heme iron. You're also not getting the endotoxin that creates the inflammation. And so it's a lot of the things you're not getting with it that might be a big part of it.
And you're getting a higher proportion of obviously antioxidants and
antioxidants, the phytonutrients, and also a much broader electrolyte spectrum. And so meat is, you know, going to be very high in the sodium that they add to it and stuff, but very low in the potassium and the other things that you need, whereas the spinach is going to have a better electrolyte balance.
Right. And so it is ultimately, it's, I mean, obviously it's a bigger picture than just protein, but it is about the amino acid makeup. And it's also about, I mean, so the question I guess somebody might be curious about is, okay, well, a cow eats grass. So why is it that the beef, if it's getting its amino acids from the grass, why is it that the beef is higher in these sulfur bearing amino acids than the plant itself? And is that due just to the amino acids that the cow creates from the essential amino acids?
Right, exactly. So you know, and keep in mind, all foods have all amino acids. It's not like there's like one food that has only this and one food that only has that. It's a broad spectrum of amino acids. It's just that the plant structure is a little bit different than the animal structure with regards to how much of a certain amino acid it has. Like, for instance, plants have more glutamic acid. But meat still has glutamic acid, whereas plants have less leucine, but meat and plants still have leucine. So it's not like they don't have any of those. But yeah, amino acids, we make amino acids all the time in our body. We take the essential amino acids that we get from our diet and then convert them into the 20 different amino acids that are out there. And it's just the way that is made in order to make muscle is very different.
And how did that myth happen of the incomplete? I know it's Francis Moore-Lepay, I think, in like the 70s, but this idea that's sort of been, it's still very much in our culture, by the way, that, okay, maybe they know you don't have to eat beans and rice, but the assumption is that plants are incomplete proteins. And I know that like Dr. McDougall listed a whole bunch of plants that we previously, you know, we thought, okay, buckwheat is complete, soybeans are complete, quinoa is complete, but then there's not much else that's complete. But he's showing all the essential amino acids exist in tons of plants.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, like, most plants are complete as far as their offerings. It's just that they have less of a certain amino acid.
Right. So when did the science in your research for your book? When did the science of that appear? When did research show that these amino acids, whatever levels they are, exist? Because the assumption, the conclusion in our culture isn't that, okay, you know, broccoli has the essential amino acid, it just has lower levels. The conclusion is that plants don't have complete proteins, or maybe every plant except for three doesn't have the 9 essential amino acids. When did the research appear to saying, well, that's just not true, and when did it go hit the mainstream, or is it hitting the mainstream?
I think it's just hitting the mainstream now. When was it discovered? When was it not? I mean, you know, there was never a discovery that it wasn't that way. So it's all been an invention that that's the case, right?
Except for, why would Francis Moore-Lepay say you know, you got to combine beans and rice. I mean, and she started it.
No, she took it back subsequently.
She did, but it and never, so nobody heard the recant.
Back, but no one heard it. But she took it back, I think, like, I think her book was written in the 70s and early 80s. She took it back and said research is actually different. But I can't, I don't know, I've got an exact answer. I mean, I could tell you where, in my mind, a lot of, look, the whole focus on protein started in the turn of the 18th to 19th century when, 19th to 20th century when they did – there was a couple different studies. One of them was a study where they basically looked at muscle tissue and its skin, and then they found the protein structure in muscle and skin and said, okay, well, protein's in all of our cells, so therefore protein must be the essential nutrient, which is why it has the name protein, from the Greek proteus meaning of importance or most important. And so by finding it in all our tissue, we say, okay, so protein's most important. And then there was another study done by Carl von Voigt where basically what he did is he said, okay, if we're going to see how much protein someone should eat or how much meat someone should eat, because at that time they just equated protein with meat because they thought of muscle tissue and of flesh being protein. And so he looked at labor workers. He looked at laborers that were doing that were building a building and looked at what they ate every day and said, well, this is what they eat, so this must be what people require, which is ridiculous that because these people are eating this, that's what a person requires is really absurd, but that's what he did. And he came to the conclusion that we needed 118 grams of protein per day. Now that was immediately tested. So, a professor at Yale tested that named Chittenden. And he tested it much more scientifically in athletes and found that they only needed 60 grams of protein a day. But that never caught on because at that time, there was a huge premium on meat, right? I mean, we weren't really worried about obesity and heart disease. People were dying way before they got heart disease. And most people were dying of infectious disease or of malnutrition, not overnutrition. And so, you know, to be a little fat was actually a social symbol of success,
right,
of
right.
having enough food. And so meat, you know, was like, oh my God, meat's high in calories. And so calories make you portly. Portly is a sign of being successful. And so people wanted to eat meat. With the Industrial Revolution and the beginning of obesity and of real big time obesity and heart disease, it, for me, a big pivotal moment came in the 1970s when the Senate Select Committee on Nutrition started to look into nutrition. They were actually charged with discovering why we had malnutrition and what we could do about it. And what they found is while there is some malnutrition in people that are starving, the vast majority of the country is overeating.
Right, right.
And they started looking into it. And they did a lot of research and they had all these trials and discussions, and they came to the conclusion that we eat too much meat, sugar, and dairy, and eggs, and we need to eat more fruits and vegetables and complex carbs. And this set off the biggest battle. You know,
I was just going to say, man.
Yeah. What's that?
I was just going to say, man, that must have hit heavy.
Oh, it hit horribly. I mean, the meat industry went crazy. They said if there's any reason that we have high blood pressure, it's because of people saying that meat causes high blood pressure, giving us stress. The egg industry went crazy, and they got together and they really lobbied hard. The chair of that committee was McGovern, and McGovern was from North Dakota, which was a big meat industry, and they lobbied hard to get him never elected again, and he was, in fact, immediately voted out of office. And the interesting is, you know, the number two recommendation that they had was eat less meat. And when the final committee report came out, that was changed by Bob Dole from Kansas from eat less meat to eat more lean meat. And so that was a huge change.
Wow.
And then what happened was out of this, basically the whole committee got disbanded. The recommendations got thrown away. And what was left was this kind of war of macronutrients. We no longer – we had previously talked about food, eat less meat, eat less dairy, eat more fruits and vegetables. Now, all of a sudden, we were talking – breaking down into the eat less fat. And so we went on this eat less fat craze, which we never really ate less fat, by the way. We actually ate more fat. But then we started eating – well, if we're eating less fat, I'm going to eat fat-free, which was, you know, Oreos that are fat-free and snack wells that are fat free, and no one got any healthier eating, you know, fat free. And so there what came out of this was this carbs versus fat. And, you know, Atkins came out and said, okay, eat more protein and you lose weight. And so all of a sudden we couldn't decide if we should eat less carbs or if we should eat less fat. But one thing we were certain of is protein. No one was questioning protein.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah.
And so protein kind of like got put onto this pedestal that it still is. It still sits on today. It's like the one thing we never argue with is protein. There's no doctor that thinks that protein – well, obviously there are some. But most doctors think that protein is good for you and that most patients need to eat as much of it as possible. And it's, you know, a very erroneous way to tell people to eat.
Well, I find it really interesting because I'm coming up much more in my own practice and everything with people who have diabetes, where their doctors are telling them to eat high protein. It's because they measure blood glucose, you know, and so when they eat a high protein meal, supposedly, or high fat, high protein, they don't measure high on the glucose, but they're not measuring insulin or the insulin's ability to do its job. And it's like, it's just a completely narrow view of the mechanism of the body. And I don't even know where that even comes from. It just blows my mind. It's like, you know, and you lay it out really well in your book. It's like, it's not really, it's not a glucose issue, not even really a blood sugar issue. It's a, can the insulin get the stuff into the cell or not, you know, and how protein plays into that and how fat plays into that.
Yeah, that's so important because a lot of, like, I told you about that guy, the Duke guy who said he couldn't show end organ disease change. And so, you know, so he puts people on these high protein, high fat diets. So you put a diabetic on a high protein, high fat diet and their blood sugar level goes down. So their A1C goes down. But that's exactly what he's saying. He said, I could show you an A1C decrease, but I'm not showing you a cure of diabetes. Because if you take this person, you do an oral glucose tolerance test, they're still diabetic.
Right.
Because they eat the sugar, their sugar level will go up. So basically what you're doing is putting a Band-Aid over the problem. The problem is utilization of carbs.
That's right.
If you take carbs away, yeah, you're dropping their blood sugar, but that's an artificial change of what the actual disease is. Disease is the fat inside the muscle cell, which is still there and actually possibly maybe increasing on this diet. And so they're still diabetic.
And I correct me if I'm wrong, but I've read that there's a measured insulin spike even on supposed high protein meals.
Oh yeah, protein spikes insulin.
And sure. So and this is just how carbs got vilified, I'm assuming, is Atkins. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's a combination of Atkins and the fact that, you know, snack wells didn't make us healthy.
Right.
So people are like, oh, we tried low fat. We ate high carb, low fat, which again, it's not true. We did not. You know, we ate high carb, high fat.
Well, and not only that, but we didn't look at the, like you said, you know, I call it heavy box. We didn't look at the micronutrient content of the food either. We were still talking about macro only.
Right, we ate a junk food diet, but their reasoning is that we ate a junk food diet and it didn't work, so therefore we need a high protein.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So, and now I'm depressed. Thank you. I appreciate that. The stress has caused me to be diabetic.
Right. Right.
Of this conversation, I mean,
it really is stressful, and I put on Facebook today because there are times that I just want to give up. I'm just like I don't know how else. What do they say? What's the saying? There's none so blind that refuse to see. You know, there's some people I can't tell you. I'm in a unique position because I treat people with diet. So a lot of people on Facebook and internet have never treated a single patient. They're talking about diet. They've never seen how a diet actually works in a person.
Right.
And follow them. I've got a very big background in science and understanding science. I've reviewed the literature. I came from a high protein background and realized the error of my ways. I've got a kind of an interesting perspective, but there's some people that just don't even want to listen. There's nothing I could tell. God could come from the sky and say, don't eat meat, and they're still going to find a way to eat it. A perfect example is Gary Tobbs. You know who Gary Tobbs is?
I know who he is. Yeah, of course.
So
big, high fat.
Very high fat, high protein, high fat. He started a fund to fund research. And of course, the idea was like to fund research to get the real ideas out. But of course, he's got a bias. He wants to show that his high fat, high protein, low carb is the way to do it. And he really believes that insulin is the problem. Well, this really big study, I mean, it was about as good as you could do a scientific study was done. They kept people in a hospital in a special room that measures metabolism and fed them a low-carb diet for 2 months. I mean, an insanely good study. And it disproved his notion that insulin is the cause of problems and actually showed that the high-protein diet caused some muscle loss. And so it totally disproved him. So instead of Gary Taubes saying, I paid for this study and it disproved my idea, so I'm going to change my views, he's gotten a bunch of doctors to try to argue with the way the scientists set up the study.
Wow.
That he paid for. He cannot possibly accept that he could be wrong. He just cannot accept it. And that's troubling. And so there's times and I put on my Facebook today that because there's times I want to quit, but you know, there's this story about this man's walking along the ocean and he sees this guy throwing starfish into the water. And he says, "Why are you throwing starfish in the water?" And the guy says, "Well, the tide is going in and these starfish are grounded on the beach, and unless I throw them in right now, they're going to die." And the other guy says, "Well, yeah, but you're crazy. There's starfish up and down this really long beach. There's thousands of them. There's no way you could throw all of them in. How could that possibly make a difference?" And the guy picks up a starfish and throws it in the water and says, "Well, it made a difference to that starfish."
Right, right.
And so I've kind of changed my focus more. I'm here now to speak to people that are willing to listen. And if you're from Testosterone Nation, I just can't be bothered. Go on doing what you want to do. Die at 45 or whatever the average bodybuilder dies at, and there's nothing much I could do about that. But if you're interested in science and the experience of someone who really has been in the front lines of this disease process, then I'm willing to talk.
Well, and I think there's an aspect of your own quality of life and your own stress and your own family, and it's like, you know, where are you going to devote your resources of mental energy to the people that you can help, you know, you know, obviously the work you're doing, I think is, supremely important. I think it's, that a doctor, given how the industry is now, I still think it's an anomaly and an incredibly courageous stance to step forward into the world that you have, that you've done and to speak on these kinds of things. So I applaud your efforts there, and I think it is making a huge difference. I also find the way that you communicate with people on Facebook to be very informed and respectful, and I appreciate that too. You don't go down into the dirt on those things.
Yeah, I try not to. Sometimes I get drawn in.
Yeah, it's never been from what I've read, it's never been too bad. So, and I don't spend a ton of time. So I'll have to look for the times where you're just getting a little bitchy. Anyway, I'm just teasing.
Oh, they're there.
What's that?
They're there.
Yeah, are they? Okay, I'll have to look. I'll have to look and then I'll post those. Anyway, well, the book is Proteinaholic, and that's been out for a little while. Is there something on your for, obviously, for people who don't get it? I've talked about it on my podcast before. So, but is there, what's next for Garth Davis?
You know, I don't know. I had a burning desire to write that book. I had something to say, and I didn't care who read it. I just needed to put it in paper. You know, I needed to capture what I see on a day-to-day basis in my clinical spectrum and what I've read. And it was very cathartic to write that book, and I'm proud of it. I mean, not in an ego way. I'm just happy that I got that out. And so I still want to, you know, I'm still, there's nothing I want to change about that book yet until I feel like I got something else to say. I'm going to keep doing what I do, which is daily helping people lose weight and get healthy.
Are you still on the front lines of research? And I mean, do you devote a certain amount of your week to looking up new studies?
I mean, I always do because, you know, there's a lot of downtime in medicine where I got to wait for a patient to get ready or wait for surgery, and that's my reading time. I've got a grant to do some actual research coming up, and so that's going to, you know, take me down a road of actually doing some of the research rather than just reading about it. I've got some ideas for things I want to do. You know, I kind of started this thing called Pharmacy, Pharmacy, where use fruit, you know, write prescriptions for fruits and vegetables rather than drugs. And so I'm working on that too. So I've got a few things that I'm working on, and we'll see where the tide takes me.
Awesome. Well, I really appreciate your time. Tell my listeners where they can find you on social media and internet in general.
I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Dr. Garth Davis, and then on Facebook it's Dr. Garth Davis, and there are some imposters out there, so be careful. There's the people that steal my pictures and say that they're Garth Davis. But anyway, it's Dr. Garth Davis. And you know, from time to time, I share studies that came out. You know, like I just today, I shared a study that just came out in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. Or I will kind of discuss a criticism if there's someone criticizing a plant-based diet. From time to time, I'll do that.
And where are you speaking next?
I'm speaking in Toronto this week at the Remedy Food Festival.
Oh, that Matt Fraser is going to be there.
Yeah, Matt will be there.
Yeah, sure. He's my buddy. Tell him hi.
Matt's a good guy.
Yeah.
And we've talked at different talks together. And then I'm going to be at Plant Fest in Pennsylvania and the Engine 2 at the Caldwell Esselstyn's farm and quite a few others.
Cool. All right. And is there a website they can find you for these appearances, or is it best to just hit social media?
I think we've got it listed at proteinaholic.com.
Okay.
I think so.
All right. Well, I really appreciate your time. It was nice to – I've now met you in person twice, once in Texas, once in New York, and brief, but always good to see you. And keep me posted on everything. And again, I love the work you do, and thanks for sharing some of that with my listeners.
Sure. Thanks. I enjoyed it.
All right. Talk to you soon.
All right, you guys, Garth Davis, huh? You kidding me? He's awesome. Listen, go get his book. It's an awesome resource. I stand behind it. Go check it out. He does due diligence like nobody's freaking business, okay? All right, couple more just super big announcement. I am drinking mushroom cocoa tonight. I got a new box. That's the biggest news in my life right now. Like, that's the biggest news in my life. Okay. Back tomorrow doing two-a-day runs for the next 3 days with Matt Fraser and the running group. So I'm gearing up for that, plus a little yoga, which I don't really do generally. But hey, you know what? I can twist it a little bit. I can do a little pretzelanama, I think is the Hindu word for that. Okay, you guys, listen, before this gets just worse and worse, thank you for joining me this week. I will be back next week. In the meantime, if you need to find me, Google Sid Garza-Hillman, social media, Sid Garza-Hillman, SidGarzaHillman.com. You can donate to the podcast, buy some merch. The website, by the way, fully redesigned, not out yet, but like it's happening. So I'm very excited about that. It's a long time coming. If you want to email me any questions, comments, or whatever, I love to hear updates from you guys, and I answer every email unless you're just nutty nut nut and just, yeah. Luckily, don't get a lot of those. Okay, so good note. Good news there. All right, you can go to podcast@SidGarzaHillman.com, podcast@SidGarzaHillman.com. Follow me on Strava, subscribe to my YouTube channel. Okay, just do that. All right, you guys. I'll be back next week with another episode of the Approaching the Natural podcast. This is Sid Garza-Hillman signing off. Until next week, be well. You're caught up with me. Sliced off memory, words were all commandeered, and in a fountain they wrote all I could see. It's a childlike offering. Caught up with me, faulted and withering, bound by nothing at all. It chose its time to be seen, and it was all I could see. How many ways will come? How many ways will come? And we'll come tenderly.
caught up with me. But this time I watched it by. Cause if the day goes downhill, so it goes downhill. So it goes downhill. How many days will come? How many days will come? How many days will come? That will come creeping quietly. How many ways will come? How many ways will come? How many ways will come? And I come in tenderly. Tenderly.